With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Hi, everyone. Good morning and welcome to First Things First. I'm Jenna Wolf. That's the Hall of Famer Chris Carter. That is Nick Wright. We were all up late watching a very interesting game last night. But we have big NFL games to preview, but why not start with the most dominant team.
I'm sorry.
There it is. That's the perfect season right there. We're going to start with the most dominant team in college football. And guess what? It's not Alabama. National title game between Clemson and the Tide, and it was Clemson who owned the night. Tigers beat the Crimson Tide 44-16 behind nearly 350 yards passing from superstar in the making Trevor Lawrence. The last time Nick Saban lost by more than two scores, he was the coach of the Miami Dolphins, just to put this in time to perspective. It is Clemson's second national title in 3 years and the first 15-0 season in modern college football history. Clemson Tigers are your national champions. Here's the head coach, Dabo Swinney, after the win.
There was a lot of talk about best ever all year long. We were never in that conversation. But tonight, there's no doubt. You know, first 15-0 team to beat Notre Dame and to beat Alabama to do it. This team won 13 games by 20 points or more and led by an unbelievable group of seniors.
That's just been amazing. The focus and how driven this team is has been unbelievable. And just these seniors have just taken me in, and they kind of dragged me along, and you know, until I got my feet under me, and they're awesome people as well as players. So
one game doesn't define who you are. But I also told the players that sometimes we learn more when things don't go well, when we lose. You have to learn how to lose as well as how you win. And there's a lot of lessons for us to learn from the experience that we had in this game.
We were killing ourselves. We shot ourselves in the foot, you know, by me throwing that interception for a touchdown and then, you know, not finishing drives the way we wanted to.
All right, guys, we spent all day yesterday asking ourselves, well, if Clemson was going to do it, how would they pull off the upset? So how shocking was this upset?
Well, I wasn't shocked at all. I thought this was the best Clemson team after watching college football. And it's great, too, because we thought in this being the fourth time they would meet, well, man, it's become a little redundant. Man, I'm tired of seeing it. Hey, this is college football. It's Clemson. It's Alabama. The rest of the teams have to step up to that because they're the only two that I see on that plateau. What I saw in Dabo Swinney was, for the first time, he's got a pure pocket passer quarterback. The first time he's had that since he's been there. So I think that that's one thing that's brought them closer to Alabama. Their offensive line, which no one talked about, which is led by a bunch of veteran players, the guys that have played a lot of games, they were able to match up with Alabama's front seven better than any other Clemson team. So I thought they would have success. How would the wide receiving core do against that secondary? That was the variable that we didn't know about. How would the freshman quarterback do under the national stage? As everyone saw for the first time on the national stage, he is a big-time player. So Dabo Swinney has this program exactly where he thought, on the same footing as Alabama, and it should be in the conversation based on a few things. One, Dabo Swinney said it in the press conference. 13 of the 15 wins by a decisive 20 points or more. That in college football is astronomical and should be noted. And, man, these players coming back after the embarrassment of last year, saying, man, we want a piece of Alabama, and them staying together as a group, it's very rare to see that in college football, and for them to get paid out with the national championship. It was outstanding. Outstanding season. Congratulations to the Clemson Tigers for being national champs.
I don't think anyone should be shocked that Clemson won the title. They were a smaller underdog than the Philadelphia Eagles were this week. I don't think people were shocked Philadelphia won that weekend. I was shocked by the margin. I was shocked that Alabama got bageled in the second half, that Clemson was able to take that early momentum. This game was 14-13 at one point. And how did it end? 44-16. So you go on a 30-3 run on Alabama. That the ability to do that did shock me, even if maybe that's because I was underselling Clemson, because every game they played this year, that young man started at quarterback and finished the game at quarterback, they won by at least 20 points. They had two games that were close. One was the A&M game early when Kelly Bryant was still the quarterback.
Yep.
And the other game was against my alma mater, Syracuse, when they got down to their third-string quarterback due to injury to Trevor Lawrence. And so maybe we should have been giving Clemson more credit. And what Dabo said was, you know, there's talked about all the greatest ever, and we were never included. You know what it reminded me of? The 2005 run-up to the Texas-USC Rose Bowl, when everyone basically had anointed USC, obviously they're going to beat Texas, and we were doing a bracket of USC versus the all-time greatest schools or teams in college football history. And then they lost that game. Now, they lost it very close in one of the greatest college football games ever. But it seemed like Clemson, who they looked at themselves and were like, hold up. On the year, we're averaging 31 a game. You're averaging 31 a game. We're averaging 530 yards per game. You're averaging 530 yards per game. We have the same record as you. Like, why is it not being discussed that there are two teams better than everyone rather than one team better than everyone? Turns out there was one team better than everyone, but it was Clemson, not Alabama.
Let's talk about Trevor Lawrence for a second. Was his style just something that Alabama hadn't been prepared for, hadn't faced all season? Why was he able to be so successful against this team?
No, the SEC is the best conference in college football. But as far as facing top-flight drop-back quarterbacks, right now they don't have those quarterbacks in the SEC. So this was the first time that this Alabama team faced a quarterback like him. And since there's a type of quarterbacks that have been successful against Nick Saban defenses at Alabama, it's been a dual threat quarterback. So people can say, well, no drop back quarterback has ever beat him. This kid's a special, all right, special player. He could be a dual threat. He's good enough. You could see at the end of the game when they were trying to run out the clock, they kept running him. So he has that athletic ability, but it's special. He's special throwing the football. And going against that secondary, one of the reasons why we didn't predict that Alabama would be like this, because we didn't know what their secondary would be like, all right? One, we didn't know Trevor Lawrence under the pressure, what would he be like? But this secondary, they lost their top six players from last year. They developed a secondary, and no quarterback could get after them during the regular season. We were able to see in this game, they were able to protect with that great offensive line and a young quarterback sat in there and made some unbelievable throws and catches. Man, the wide receivers for Clemson, they played like they were pro wide receivers in last night's game.
And Alabama, whether it was Nick Saban deciding very early in the game, this is a fourth down game, which I understood, the fake field goal struck a lot of people as odd when the game was still in the balance. And Tua, we talked at halftime, C, what did you say is Tua's number one attribute? His number one skill that people like about him?
For people who don't know him, it's his leadership in knowing football, knowing where people were going to be at. So seeing him surprised a couple times by the blitz.
Surprised by the blitz, and on the second interception, the thing that he's been great at is knowing where he threw that ball before the receiver was basically in route and without knowing where the defense was going to be. But he's been doing that all year. He was just wrong on what he saw. And that's, I guess, a credit to Brent Venables and the Clemson staff, for putting together that game plan. But you also saw, this is, I felt, one of the only downsides to blowing people out throughout the year until that game against Georgia, where you don't have a ton of experience of things aren't going well for us. Now, Tua has the experience of last year's national championship game. But in that game, he was almost playing, to use a cliche, house money. You
yes.
come in, you're a true freshman. It's not
no
your team.
Anything.
You're asked to bring your team back from 13 down at halftime. This is different. You are the favorite. They are talking about you as a guy that could have won the Heisman this year, should win it next year, greatest team ever, and things aren't going well. And Clemson seized on that. And Clemson, even without one of their best defensive linemen, that defensive front that has pros up and down it, they made their impact on the game. And you talked about their offensive line, which is something I didn't hear many people talking about. Their offensive line kept Trevor Lawrence upright and comfortable throughout
yeah,
the entire
no
football
doubt.
Game.
Tell me the last game you know Nick Saban and he coached that they didn't have a sack or a turnover.
It's unbelievable.
You'd be hard-pressed to be able to try to find. So up front, been able to match Alabama. They negated that great defensive front that they have and their ability to be able to run the ball just enough against Alabama to set up that lethal passing.
We're going to talk a lot more about this game and what this means for Clemson in the grand scope of college football coming up in a little bit. But on the other side, what does Sean McVay think of Ezekiel Elliott? You'll hear it next on First Things First. Stay with us.
Hey, it's Nick Wright, and we all put off doing things we know we need to do. We know we need to organize the garage, but something always gets in the way. Funny how home security can be just like that. You know it's a good idea, but there's always something holding you back. Well, now is the time to act, because SimpliSafe Home Security's extended holiday sale ends soon. SimpliSafe believes nothing should come between you and protecting your home. So they've gotten rid of the reasons not to get home security. There's no contract ever, no price markups from any middleman, no installation windows. Who's got time for that? Most importantly, their system is engineered to do one thing brilliantly, and that thing is protect. So if a storm takes out your power, SimpliSafe is ready. If an intruder cuts your phone line, SimpliSafe is ready. If they destroy your keypad or siren, SimpliSafe will still get you the help you need. Go to simplisafe.com/FTF. And listen here, order before January 8th is over to save with their extended holiday sale. That's simplisafe.com/FTF. Simplisafe.com/FTF.
Yeah. Back to the NFL now. The Rams enjoyed their bye last week, waiting to see who they'd host in the division round this weekend. Turns out it'll be a hot Cowboys team led by a quarterback in Dak Prescott with a ton of confidence right now, and a running back in Ezekiel Elliott, who's been great all season. In fact, this game could very well come down to a battle of the two best running backs in the NFL, with Zeke and Todd Gurley. And head coach Sean McVay says the two have a lot in common.
When you look at Zeke, I think he's, similar to Todd, one of the most complete backs in the league, extremely productive. I think he's got the ability to go through you or go around you with speed. He's gotten a lot more involved in the pass game this year. I think he's truly a complete back, and you could see that, a lot of what they do is predicated on, just him getting a bunch of touches.
It's interesting. We've seen this season that both of these young third-year quarterbacks, oftentimes their game goes as their running backs seem to go. How much differently are Zeke and Gurley, CC, used by their respective teams?
Man, they're used. They are the focal point of that offense, but just used in a variety of different ways. Zeke is the traditional eye tailback. This year, having more productivity as a receiver out of the backfield, so having his best year as a pro, as a receiver, as a complete running back. Coming out of college, didn't know that at Ohio State because they didn't throw the ball to him. And, they ran a Veer-type system with the quarterback in the shotgun, but he is the most dominant running back between the tackles. I believe he's the best pure runner of the football. And he, because of carries and volume, you have to put a number of people in the box. So he's going to force you to commit 7 guys to that line of scrimmage, which opens up coverage on the outside. On the other side, Sean McVay, what they like to do, a lot of motion, a lot of things, but at the end of the day, they want to run the ball between the tackles with Todd Gurley. But a lot of it is window dressing just to make things to set up their passing game. So Todd Gurley, just through the way they run their running game, setting up their play action. Ezekiel Elliott, because they're going to run him 20 times, and then when he touches it 20 times, they're unstoppable. They set up the passing game different ways, but both of them utilize very, very successful for these offenses.
The Rams and Sean McVay are the way they use Todd Gurley. It's almost like a good magician, like trying to make you look at a bunch of different places as opposed to where you should be looking. They do so much of that window dressing just to get the defense's attention briefly off the best player on the field, which is Todd Gurley, and they want to get him the ball. Both of these teams have this in common. This year, the Cowboys, when Zeke has 20 or more carries, they're 7-0. Over the last 2 years, the Rams, when Gurley has 20 or more touches, they're 17-1. So the reason it's carries versus touches is because Gurley is more of a guy that will catch more passes out of the backfield, at least in his career up until this season before Zeke added that to his game. These are your two best backs in football. It's a matter of taste. Do you prefer a guy that is more more traditional in the sense of, I'll say Earl Campbell almost, and a guy that's just going to, you're going to, I formation, hand it to him, Adrian Peterson, and maybe a better contemporary example.
Yes, because of the speed.
Because of the speed and the ability, like, not going to catch a lot of passes, and Zeke's done better at that this year, but you know what he's going to do. Or in a guy like Todd Gurley, who is, to me, more of a modern-day almost Marshall Faulk, which is he can beat you a bunch of different ways. Not quite the receiver Faulk was, but really dynamic and a great athlete. Both of these guys have to have a great game on Sunday, or Saturday night, pardon me, for their team to have the best chance to win. For the Cowboys, it's to have any chance to win.
I was just going to say, the Rams can take more chances if Gurley either isn't getting as many touches or isn't finding as much success. The Cowboys need Zeke to play well. They need him to help set up Dak, right, for what he's going to do. I guess you could say the Rams have more, would you say they have more weapons on offense?
They have more weapons, but I have to disagree with you just a little bit. Todd Gurley, if he doesn't have a big day in the Coliseum, they will lose. Now, he's going against a better run defense, and I expect them to be able to hold his numbers down. But Todd Gurley, man, if he's not touching the ball 22 times in this game, no, they don't have the guys. Foster's a nice receiver. Cooks is a good receiver, but they're not going to dominate the game. They're not going to take over the game, and they have missed Cooper Kupp in that slot. Their overall productivity, if you take away those 48 points they scored in week number 17, man, they're getting around three touchdowns in those three or four games leading up to that. So this Rams team that we saw late in the season, it was not the Rams team that we saw the first 2 months of the season.
And to me, the most interesting part of this football game is going to be for the national audience to see, is this Rams defense actually good? This offseason, when you think about the big acquisitions they made, yes, they traded for Brandon Cooks. But their big acquisitions were on defense. They brought in Aqib Talib. They brought in Marcus Peters. They brought in Ndamukong Suh. They retain Aaron Donald on a huge deal. They trade midseason for Dante Fowler. They have the personnel to be better than they've been defensively. Now, I know some people, I like Wade Phillips a lot, and I know Wade Phillips very well, their defensive coordinator. His history says his defense is in year one pop, in year two regress a bit, and then recover in year three. We're in year two, but this is a critical year two. This team was one and done in the postseason last year. Didn't have to be. They end up there. They're at home now. They're off a bye. I'm confident that the offense is going to be at least okay against this Cowboys defense, as good as the Cowboys defense is, because I think they have enough different ways to put points up on the board. Even when they were slowed, they were still scoring an average of 20 points a game going into week 17. I want to see if this defense gets gashed by Zeke, because all year long they have struggled stopping the run despite having Donald and Sue up the middle, which would make you think you shouldn't struggle stopping the run. Maybe struggle edge pass rush, but I never thought this team would be awful against the run up the middle.
Yeah, another thing I want fans to watch and listen for in the telecast in the game is listen for the crowd noise, because I believe that Dallas will have at least equal footing in the Coliseum. A lot of Cowboys fans in Southern California. The fan base in L.A. is growing for football with the Chargers and the Rams. They should be as excited about football like no other time. Watch for the crowd noise. So if they get that running game going of the Cowboys, Zeke gets to eating, those fans, just watch. I have never seen a team with a number two seed that did not have home field advantage playing at home.
Yeah.
And I believe that's going to be an intriguing storyline to this game this weekend.
I want to throw one curveball question at you. I didn't ask you about this before the show.
Yeah, no problem. I can hit the curve.
Okay, assuming good weather, which is a good assumption in Southern California, and the weather report says good weather, does that favor one team or the other, one quarterback or the other? Is that about a neutral situation?
No, it's neutral. As far as these offenses, the way they're running, yes. I would consider that to be not a factor in this game.
All right, let's take a break.
That wasn't a curveball. That was a straight fastball.
No problem.
Coming up, four seamer. Could Dwayne Haskins go number one overall? That's next on First Things First. On Sunday night, tune in to FS1 for a big super middleweight title fight as Jose Uzcategui defends his belt against undefeated Caleb Plant. It's live Sunday at 6:30 Eastern on FS1 and the Fox Sports app. All right, time for stories to start your morning. Well, basketball, Lakers snapped their three-game losing streak last night, beating the Mavericks 107-97. Brandon Ingram led the way with 29 points. Nick, what was your takeaway from this one?
Excellent second half by the Lakers in a game they needed after struggling immensely without LeBron. Looked like this was going to be a continuation of that trend. Down 15 at the half. Mm-hmm. Josh Hart hit a nice little buzzer beater right at the half. Gave him a little momentum. And Brandon Ingram, second most points he scored in an NBA game at 29. He hadn't been able to crack that 26-point threshold all year. Good game by him. Good game by Lonzo, despite Kuz struggling immensely in his game back.
Yeah, they're in the eighth spot in the West now. Man, it's critical that they try to just hold serve until LeBron gets back. But it's a dangerous time for them, man. They need to win a few games with LeBron being out of the lineup.
When's he
big
coming
win
back,
last
Nick?
Night.
I don't know. That's playing a pretty home severe against the Cavs. You know, in 6 days. I don't
wish
know.
Wish y'all listen to me about those injuries. LeBron said it, Pop. Man, this is not significant. Oh, you'll be back in a few days. Shh. Okay.
Excuse me. All right, let's move on to Jimmy Butler. The saga continues. Reports are he isn't happy with his role with the Sixers. This after not being happy with his role with the Timberwolves. But Philly's not giving up on him quite yet, according to more reports. The Sixers have refused calls from teams looking to acquire Butler. Nick, what'd you make of this?
Jimmy Butler needs to talk with somebody, get with somebody. I don't know if it's a life coach or just personality conflict coach. Jimmy Butler, what does Stink say? When everywhere you walk smells, maybe it's you. Like, Jimmy Butler, you had beef with people in Chicago. You had beef with people in Minnesota. You're not having beef already in Philadelphia. Maybe it's a Jimmy Butler problem. He carries himself like he's bringing this championship pedigree to any team he goes to. He's won two series, not championship series, in his career. Like, come on, Jimmy, chill out, man.
Well, I don't have a problem with this. And the reason why, because they do have an offensive problem. And it's a legitimate question. Now, how he presented that, and now because he's done these things in Minnesota, but they got an offensive problem. So he's got a high basketball IQ. And high basketball IQ guys, they will challenge the coaches. I didn't have a problem with him challenging, but he needs to be. You have to play with somebody, Jimmy. Yeah. It's a team sport. Yeah. All right? So they do need to get their offensive problems
agreed
worked out.
That.
So that is legitimate.
All right, let's move back to the football now in the NFL. The Packers are reportedly hiring Titans offensive coordinator Matt LaFleur to be their head coach. LaFleur spent time with Sean McVay in L.A. before this past role in Tennessee. Chris, what'd you make of this hire?
I thought it was a good hire. And Matt LaFleur is one of those kind of guys, when you meet him 15 minutes, you think ultimately he's going to be calling the NFL offense, running some type of franchise. So I'm thinking, now they might have reached a little bit early for him, because he doesn't have the experience there in Tennessee. You're not going to see his skill set based on what they did in Tennessee. He will adapt. It will be more like Sean McVay and what they do with Los Angeles, but I believe a bright, young offensive mind who will challenge Aaron Rodgers. So I like the hire of the Packers, and I like the fact that they got out there fast and was able to get one of the better candidates immediately.
Yeah, one of the only benefits of firing a coach midseason is theoretically you get a jump start on this process. Packers took advantage of that. So people should know he was the quarterback's coach in Atlanta the year Matt Ryan won MVP and they went to the Super Bowl. He was with the Rams last season but wasn't calling plays. He was hired based on, I would imagine, his interview and the ideas he presented rather than the resume of what the Titans did this year offensively, because what the Titans did this year offensively was not impressive, but he didn't really have the quarterback situation or the receivers to be impressive. It's a risky hire by Green Bay to hire a first-time head coach for this last phase of Aaron Rodgers' career, but they took the risky
path. And this is where NFL owners are going. Sean McVay didn't have the resume either. No. When he went to Washington, you're like, hey, what offense is he going to run? And then when he got to L.A., we saw a different offense. So that's what the Packers are hoping for.
All right, let's move on. To declare or not to declare, that is the question, if you're Dwayne Haskins. And it turns out the Ohio State quarterback who led the Buckeyes to a Rose Bowl win and a 13-1 record this season will declare. He'll enter the 2019 NFL Draft. Haskins is the presumptive favorite to be the first quarterback taken in the draft. Could be the first Big Ten quarterback selected in the first round since 1995. So you see, how good can Haskins be?
Well, he's the best quarterback that's ever come from that institution. They've been playing football over 120 years. He's absolute by far the best thrower. People might have missed the season. 50 touchdown passes. Now, I don't like the fact only starting 14 or 15 games, because typically we have seen quarterbacks be more successful in the pros. But given his situation, given that he can be a top 10, given that he is the first at his position, he's got to be able to come out of school, even though he doesn't have those 30 starts, 25 starts that we would like. He has a touch, has a big-time arm, is a competitor, is a great leader, is not a diva, not a high-maintenance guy. So if you want to have a young guy to be the face of your franchise for a number of years, I believe he's as good a prospect as we've seen come into the league in the last several years. So what he did at Ohio State and revamped that offense with Ryan Day, we hadn't seen that. Art Schleister, 1982, last quarterback from Ohio State. You mentioned the Big Ten quarterbacks. That is just not a conference that produces a lot of NFL. I believe that Haskins is the brightest that we've seen in a long time.
That is a crazy stat, that no Big Ten quarterbacks have taken the first round since Kerry Collins in 95. I think people hear, they're like, what about Drew Brees? Drew Brees was the very top of the second round when he was taken by then the San Diego Chargers. But I'm pretty close with a prominent Ohio State alum who I might have gone to a game with last year, who even last year was talking about this kid, Dwayne Haskins. Even when they had four-year captain starting quarterback at the time, the name's escaping me, I forgot. The quarterback.
JT Barrett.
JT Barrett, thank you, apologies. Being told and people talking that when this kid gets on the field, he is going to change the way Ohio State traditionally plays football because of his ability to vertically pass the football.
Somewhat the situation Trevor Lawrence in Clemson.
Yes.
They were trying to take that offense to a different level. Pure drop back, big time thrower. That's what Clemson had. That's what Ohio State had in Haskins.
And so the only knock on him is experience. And so he could have come back for another year. You come back for another year, then you're maybe not the number one quarterback in your class. There's a lot of questions that come up. He had said about a month ago in an interview, because he's from the tri-state area in New Jersey, I think, that he would love to be taken by the Giants. Now, it was kind of a leading question. The Giants are the type of situation that could be ideal for him because of the lack of experience, where it's not a team that wants him to start immediately, where he can learn from a veteran quarterback and then take the reins either midseason or in year two. Because I believe in the talent. I do think it's very difficult for quarterbacks that only start the 1 year in college to come in and instantly make an impact. Mitch Trubisky was in a similar position.
Sure.
He's still getting his footing, and he's played a couple years of pro football at this point.
And you think his game translates to the pros pretty well?
Oh, he can throw it. He can throw it to any part of the field. He's got touch on the short passes, intermediate we saw during the season, and being able to read coverages and not throw interceptions. He's got a big arm, but he doesn't take a lot of chances with the football. Still throwing in single digits as far as interceptions with those 50 touchdowns. Pretty special. I believe he's going to be a really good pro.
All right, let's move back to last night's game again. Yesterday, we wondered what it would take for Clemson to pull off the upset over Alabama. The answer was Trevor Lawrence. Oh, and a great all-around Tigers team. They beat the Crimson Tide 44-16 behind nearly 350 passing yards out of Trevor Lawrence. It is Clemson's second national title in 3 years, the first 15-0 season in modern college football history. Clemson Tigers are your national champs. Here's Clemson's head coach, Dabo Swinney, after the win.
There was a lot of talk about best ever all year long. We were never in that conversation. But tonight, there's no doubt. You know, first 15-0 team to beat Notre Dame and to beat Alabama to do it. This team won 13 games by 20 points or more and led by an unbelievable group of seniors.
One game doesn't define who you are. But I also told the players that sometimes we learn more when things don't go well, when we lose. You have to learn how to lose as well as how you win. And there's a lot of lessons for us to learn from the experience that we had in this game. Whether you're a senior who's leaving or whether you're a player who's coming back and you see that we have work to do.
All right, Nick, when you look at what Clemson did not only this year but what has been doing the last couple of years, can you now put these two programs on equal footing?
I think you have to in the right here and now. Over the last 4 years, they're both 55-4. They're both two times champions. They're both in the playoff every single year. They're 2-2 against each other. And I think more importantly than what I think, what the young athletes think, what the high school players think, that Clemson has on their roster as freshmen this year. The number one player from Ohio, got a pretty damn good football school in Ohio. They got the number one player from Alabama, they got a pretty good football school in Alabama. And what Dabo Swinney has done is, to me, the only thing I can compare it to is what Coach K did at Duke when he took over a team that was not a blue blood, that was not one of these all-time great programs, and turned it into one. If at the beginning of this decade, when Nick Saban had already won a title in Alabama and was setting up this infrastructure, if you'd have come to me or I think anyone and said, hey, there's going to be one team that by the end of the decade is toe-and-toe, neck-and-neck with Alabama, year in, year out, people might have said SC. They might have said Oklahoma. They might have said Ohio State. They might have said Texas. Might have said Florida.
Not Clemson.
Clemson wouldn't have been one of the first 15. Clemson, yeah, they won a national title in 81. They before this run, they had the same history of 25 other college football programs in a place that hasn't been historically a hotbed to recruit from for them. They're competing with SEC schools. Like, what he has done there is remarkable. It has created a new powerhouse program in college football out of nearly thin air. So right now, contemporaneously, they and Alabama are clearly neck and neck. And what he is doing in remaking what Clemson football is, to me, is nothing short of remarkable.
Yeah, there's a lot of good programs in college football. But right now, the creme de la creme happens to be Clemson and Alabama. And last week, in talking with Ryan Day, and in the last couple of days, because we got a lot of kids, they're going to come out of school, and I've been just conversating with the coach. He's recruiting Ohio, and he's recruiting the nation, but it's in with Clemson and Alabama in mind. He's saying, yeah, I need kids. I want kids from Ohio. Yeah, I want kids from around the nation. Yes, but if these kids can't help me beat Clemson and Alabama, that's the standard in college football. And with Ohio State having one of the top five programs, one of their coaches telling me, yes, I think everyone else in college football should recognize Clemson and Alabama, they are a step above Georgia, Texas, Ohio State, and Michigan. And these other schools are going to have to, from a quarterback standpoint, be able to protect that quarterback and getting after the quarterback. You're going to have to be able to match what these teams have been able to do. And what I think is more important, especially with the retirement of Urban Meyer, there's only one coach on the level of Nick Saban, right, and that's Dabo Sweeney. All the other, there is no other. There are no legendary coaches in college football. Dabo Sweeney and Nick Saban are the only two on that level. Everyone else is aspiring to get to that level. So not only from a coaching standpoint, because that helps recruiting.
Sure.
All right? Because you can go in there and say, yeah, man, we stood eye to eye with the Beast four times in the last several years, and we whooped them twice. That right there is the best stat that Clemson has going for him.
And the other schools we've seen go on a, you know, 4 or 5 year run, they either had historical or infrastructure recruiting advantages. We saw what Urban did at Florida, that unbelievable run. But it is not, it shouldn't have been shocking to anyone that you get an all-time great head coach in a place like the University of Florida that he can build a juggernaut. We've seen what the University of Miami has done multiple times over the last 30 years, what SC did under Pete Carroll. All of those made sense to me. Like what Oklahoma, I know they only won the one title with Stoops, but what they were able to do in, year out, being a top five team, Florida State with Bowden, like all yeah. those things made sense. For the reason I brought up the Coach K example is for a guy to take over a smart kid school in Chapel Hill backyard, North Carolina's backyard, and then all of a sudden make them the premier program in college basketball, how does that happen? Clemson, to do what he's done in the SEC's backyard, in a school that had always been a second-tier football school compared to the top teams, is remarkable to me.
How did he do it? What can you pinpoint and say, well, this is where it really changed, or this is where it really happened, or this is where the school really made the turn?
Yeah, Clemson's had a lot of good players for a long, long time, and they've been in the ACC. That's been dominated by Florida State. But when you look at what's been happening from a population standpoint in the United States, a lot of people are moving south. A lot of the factories and stuff closed down. Yep. So Pennsylvania, Ohio, and the population, it's been affected. There's less human bodies in the north than in the south. So people have populated to the south, and University of South Carolina have not taken advantage of that being a hotbed. South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, within a 600-mile radius, there is a bunch of good football players. So Clemson was very, very close. Dabo Sweeney. Dabo is a special personality, a great leader, and now they've been able to get the quarterback, the prototype. They had Deshaun Watson, and now they have Lawrence. So when you can do those types of things, stack recruiting class on recruiting class, and he's got really, really good big people. Great offensive line and depth on the defensive line that stood together
for
4 or 5 years.
What Alabama was known to be able to do, recruiting class on recruiting class.
Oh, absolutely. Like, that is, you want to know who's going to be in the top 10 in college football.
College football is about recruiting.
Yeah, look, you want to know who's going to be in the 2019 top 10? Go look at the 2015 Rivals recruiting rankings. Like, you want to know and look at the top 10 there. That is, those things, it is all about getting the players, but then it's also about developing the players, and that's where the university gets credit. They've given, the other advantage Saban has always had is, or I shouldn't say always had, but has had recently is, you have the ability to pay coordinators like coaches, head coaches at some places, position coaches like coordinators. What'd you say Brent Venables makes?
Oh, over $2 million as a defensive coordinator. So now they have the resources.
Yeah.
They have the facilities. There's nothing you can use against them negatively as far as recruiting. Man, Clemson is here to stay, and Dabo Sweeney, that, like, you don't have to worry about recruiting against him because, oh, he's going to go to his alma mater. He played at Alabama, but he's at home in Clemson, so he's going to be there for a long, long time.
It's his dream job. Like, it's at least it's turned into his dream job. It's not the – there is not a job you could offer Dabo Sweeney that he would say, I want to leave Clemson.
No, not because it's 2 national championships that come against beating Alabama.
Right. So, I mean, he has made them into the – it's and for, to win the game the way they want it, because the first 2 games were coin flip games. Either team could have won it, but they could have lost them both. Last year, they got beat soundly. To whoop Alabama the way they did last night was as impressive a performance I've seen in college football in a very long time.
Guys.
Yeah.
This with you two. My dream job.
Oh, thank you, Jenna Wolf. We don't have to worry about her going anywhere, see?
I'm over here, see? Right over here. Just like 3 degrees this way. Gotta take
my
a break.
Dream job.
Awesome. That went well. Coming up, how can the Eagles...
tell the truth, stop lying on TV.
I am not lying on TV.
How
did the Eagles pull off the upset in the Superdome? Malcolm Jenkins has the answer ahead on First Things First. Back here, First Things First, look who's here. Former Pro Bowl cornerback Brandon Flowers, who CC called great guy and very handsome.
Oh,
so
yes,
now you
God.
Can
I've
say
been,
instead
I've been
of me.
Since
my
he was
man.
A kid.
This
my
is
man.
One of the frustrating things about working with Chris Carter. It's a good thing, but it's frustrating. I saw we were MB Flow on the show. I come into the morning meeting, I'm all excited. I'm like, man, I've known Brandon for 12 years.
Yeah.
Known him since he was a rookie in Kansas City.
Days.
Him and B. Carr, the whole. And Chris, like, man, I used to babysit him. I knew him when he was 14 years old. Trained him.
I won some money in high school.
I grew up in a game under Chris. He taught us how to be sharp, approach the game a certain way. So yeah,
we got our hair cut the same spot
exactly.
for the same time.
Exactly.
I mean, but this is the thing though. When we came to Fox, I was like, hey, Nick, you want a radio show? He'd be like, yeah, I'm excited, a radio show. He'd be like, hey, you got Chris Carter. You want a TV show? So
yeah,
that's
no,
how things happen.
Again, I'm not complaining.
he's complaining.
Just living the life. I ain't complaining.
We are happy to have you, Brandon.
Thank
sit
you,
back,
man.
Relax. Let's talk some football. All right, here we go, Brandon. Two of the best quarterbacks of our generation will match wits this weekend when Philip Rivers and the Chargers head into Foxborough to take on Tom Brady and the Patriots. It'll be the first time the two have faced off in the playoffs in over a decade. Brady called this game the most important 3 hours of the season, and he's right for him. Rivers says while he is looking forward to the matchup, he knows he has to be focused on much more.
I got to focus on that defense. Nah, I'm not playing Tom by any means. But is it special to go to New England against a Hall of Fame coach and arguably the best quarterback ever to play and get another shot at him? Heck yeah. Heck yeah, it is. It is special. And, just like I always told you, look over and it's Peyton Manning, you know, on the other side. I'm not playing those guys, but I have a great deal of respect, fan of those guys, you know. And so to get an opportunity again to go against them 11 years after we had that opportunity in, you know, the 2007 season, it's awesome and looking forward to it.
Already talks like a coach. All right, Brandon, if the Chargers are going to go into New England and pull off the upset, how are they going to do it? What's going to be the key to this game?
The key to the game is hitting Brady. This team gets pressure with Joey Bosa, Melvin Ingram. They throw so many different looks at you, like the Ravens last week. 7 DBs. You don't know where the blitz is coming mm-hmm. from. And let's be clear, the Chargers are the best team coming in here, and they know it. You know, they can play defense, they can run the football, and they got a quarterback that's been there before.
So you're saying if you roster the roster, man, the Chargers, you like their roster, talent, more so than New England.
I love the Chargers roster. They have the top 2 rosters in the NFL, in my opinion. They can match up on the outsides with anybody. Gus Bradley is a great defensive coordinator. And who do you want besides Phillip Rivers to go in there in a shootout with Tom Brady?
I think they built to beat the New England Patriots.
Man, a couple things. Gus Bradley made the huge adjustment last week. He had a couple safeties in the box, played seven DBs. Going into Gillette this week, would you come up with that game plan and something else, or how would you attack them?
You have to come in with the same game plan because you can blitz out of seven DBs on a field, and Tom Brady won't know where it's coming from. Tom Brady loves to hit the running backs out of the backfield. You don't want linebackers matched up against these guys. You want safeties that can run and tackle in space.
So even though they, man, we played 58 snaps with these DBs, you're going to present that to Brady. I know you're going to have a plan B, but you're saying let's start the game with the seven same DBs that we had success with the Ravens.
You have to. You can't let Tom Brady get going and then try to adjust. Have these DBs on the field. They, man, these DBs are hungry. We wanted to do this when I was playing at San Diego. I'm glad Gus Bradley has trusted Ron Miles, the DB coach, to put these guys on the field and let them just go out and play and have fun.
And I want people to understand how unprecedented what the Chargers did this past weekend was. I was listening to Robert Mays yesterday on his podcast, and he brought up the exact number. So they played 58 of 59 snaps with seven defensive backs. We said that on the show yesterday. What I didn't know was across the entire NFL this season, all 256 games of the regular season, no team had played more than 18 snaps with seven defensive backs in a game. So this was, I mean, this was talking about something no one was prepared for. Nobody had played more than a quarter of a game in this personnel. They played the entire game. That can't work unless you have elite safety play. They have a first-team All-Pro, Derwin James. Adrian Phillips played out of his mind. You happen to be blessed in playing in some secondaries with some outstanding safeties. As a corner, what does having a safety that can do a little bit of everything, play a little linebacker even when he's playing safety, what does it allow for you to do, and what versatility does it allow for the defense?
You can run so many different coverages because you have safeties on this team that can cover, they can blitz, but get to the quarterback, not just send a body. Derwin James, when he blitzes, he gets home every time. Adrian Phillips, he's a ball hawk. You know, he's either stripping the ball, he's getting interception. If you blitz Desmond King out of the nickel, he gets to the he gets home every time.
Yeah, he's got great speed.
So it's just so much these guys can do and do well. You just don't do it. They get home when you send them on blitzes.
Brendan, I know you said roster to roster you like this Chargers team, but this is a Chargers team. Phillip Rivers hasn't beaten Tom Brady yet in his career. They're going into Gillette where, I mean, the Patriots have been fantastic at home this year. They haven't lost
they're
a game
at home.
They're
only undefeated team.
Is there something about that lure, if you will, that can be intimidating to, I would say, a young team or, you know, younger guys on the team, but just the team as a whole when you're the visiting team?
I think the fact that Phillip Rivers haven't won there is why he will get the win. He's a revenge type of guy. You can see the fire in his eyes. In his interviews, he can't wait to step on that field. I know all during practice, he's just twitching to get in that stadium and get the job done. He's going to go in there relentless. I can't wait to see it.
Give us a little insight, because I know you signed there as a free agent. He didn't know you, but I know you're a guy. You like to talk. You're very, very competitive. What were the practices like, and what was Phillip Rivers? Because I know some of his sound bites of him talking trash in the game, I mean, they're one of a kind. He says a lot, but he never uses profanity. So what is it like going against a veteran quarterback like him?
You know how you hear some players that they practice like they playing a game? This guy does it to the T. I'm talking about talking in practice, calling out blitzes. He can look at the defensive line and just let you know where blitz is coming. He'll shout to the defensive coordinator, "I know what blitz you in," and he'll strike a path to light it up. So I can't wait to see this guy go on the field. With him fired the way he is, with Tom Brady, how fired this guy is, it's going to be fireworks out
there. And he mentioned the last time they got a chance to play the Pats in a game like this. It's 2007. How long ago was that? Since then, you have been drafted, played, retired, gotten into television. Since Phillip Rivers last had a chance. Like, I thought you said it in passing, Jenna. I think it's really noteworthy. Phillip Rivers played Tom Brady seven times in his career. 0-7. And they've had some good teams now. They've had LaDainian Tomlinson. They've had a couple teams that were the one or the two seed. Has never been able to beat the Pats. For Phillip Rivers, the only thing missing from his resume is a Super Bowl appearance, Super Bowl championship. The numbers, the reason that when we talk about that draft class, he very often is the third name mentioned is because Big Ben's got the stats and the rings. Eli's got the rings against Tom Brady twice. Phillip Rivers just has the regular season success. Has one deep playoff run to the AFC Championship game. They play with torn ACL. It's not an exaggeration to say this is the biggest game Phillip Rivers played in over a decade. This is the second biggest game he's played in his entire career. And I agree with you on the talent. I think the Chargers, I think the Patriots were rooting so hard for the Texans. They wanted the Texans. They wanted Bill O'Brien. Exactly. They did not want to have to face either that Ravens defense or this Chargers well-rounded team. And I'm curious to see that the story see was the what the DBs did in that game. But what the DBs did doesn't work if those D linemen aren't dominating the Ravens front. Melvin Ingram, Joey Bosa, those guys.
Yeah, I expect the defensive front to be able to get after it, but I'm a little different than B. I need a couple different looks for Tom Brady, all right? I believe that the DBs match up well with the wide receivers, as you mentioned. None of the wide receivers from New England are going to scare you, but I need a curveball, I need a screwball, I need something else for Tom Brady to give him more looks than they did in Baltimore, because this is not Lamar Jackson.
All right, Brandon, stick around. Got to take a break. Coming up, what can the Colts do to slow down Pat Mahomes? Next on First Things First. Back here with former Pro Bowl cornerback Brandon Flowers. Patrick Mahomes is preparing for his first career playoff game as a starter. He and the Chiefs will take on the Colts at home on Saturday. And after throwing for 50 touchdowns and over 5,000 yards this season, Andy Reid thinks he's ready for the moment.
So far, I haven't seen anything that's really too big for Pat. I'm not even worried about that. He's going to get himself ready just like he does every week to play against a good football team. So, but I don't think he's wired the other way. And I'm not predicting anything. That's not what I'm doing here. I'm just telling you, matter of fact, how he's wired and how he goes about his business.
Brandon, we saw Lamar Jackson take the stage last weekend. The moment was a little too big for him. It wasn't too big for Deshaun Jackson. So it goes Deshaun Watson, rather. Excuse me. It kind of goes both ways depending on who the quarterback is. The guy that Andy Reid just described seems to be a level-headed, low-key guy who doesn't get too flustered by the moments. What do you think the key will be for this Colts defense to slow down or stop Patrick Mahomes and this Chiefs offense?
I think Patrick Mahomes falls in that Drew Brees, Tom Brady category where to stop him, you have to keep him off the field. Don't let him get in rhythm, getting back on the field, scoring points, the defense getting stops. I think you have to run the ball on offense with Andrew Luck and just be efficient going down the field and don't let him back on the field so quick and so often. And once he gets on offense, you have to take away Tyreek Hill. That's his money guy. That's his deep ball guy. And just stop the run. If those two things don't get going, I think Andy Reid gets a little impatient. And that's when his play calling starts to, you know, go off the script and go off the map. And that's when Kansas City can be had.
And listen, the Chiefs are the best front-running team in football. There's no question about that. You get behind against Kansas City. I know the Chargers were able to execute that late comeback, but that has not been the script. The Chiefs have been a team, if they jump out to a lead, they beat you. And they have shown the ability to come back when they've been down a couple scores, as they did against the Pats to tie it, against the Rams to take a lead. I am not – I know the Colts have the number one defense in football since week 7. I do not think this Colts defense is set up to slow down Patrick Mahomes. They run this Tampa 2, but if you look at the advanced numbers, what Pat Mahomes has done against zone schemes all year, he's been great against everything. He's been particularly great against defenses like the one the Colts like to run. I totally agree with you. The only way the Colts can slow down Pat Mahomes is that Pat Mahomes sitting on the sideline wearing a parka waiting for his next chance. It's a running game for the Colts. It's a time of possession game because I do not think the Colts defense, as good as it's been, is going to keep them out of the end zone.
Yeah, I think the Colts are the worst matchup for the Chiefs because they can go ball control. They can do it different. They can run Marlon Mack or Andrew Luck can just pick that defense apart. Now, Kansas City, man, and I played against Kansas City. I've watched you play in Kansas City. The defensive backs that they have, when they take a picture of the greatest, and they're coached by one of the greats,
Emmitt Thomas,
he's a Hall of Famer. He's their coach in Kansas City. This group of DBs, absent of Eric Berry, will not be in y'all's picture. Uh-huh. I mean, because for years, they have played man-to-man, they have played great defense, and we're just not going to see that. So I'm concerned about Andrew Luck. I'm concerned about that running game. Now, as far as Indy's defense, what is cover two, all right? Cover two is based on we can take you out of your running game with a basic either 4-2 front or 4-2 nickel. And if Kansas City does not run the football, this is where they will miss. Kareem Hunt. And this is where if Andy loses his patience, if Patrick Mahomes plays like a younger player, loses his patience, because against a cover two, you have to be able to run the ball and you have to be patient enough to check the ball down. You have to go on 12 to 10 play drives, and that's what you're going to have to see in this
and
game.
And that's your concern about Mahomes is the you've been high on Mahomes, but your concern is, and what you've verbalized to me is it's third and four, and you have the ability to throw it 6 yards for a first down, and he throws it 40 yards to try to go for the kill shot, right?
Like, does he have the ability to turn into Breeze and Brady and be methodical?
Yeah.
Right now, Patty Mahomes gets turned on behind the back pass and the three-pointer. But will he be methodically and just be able to bleed you like these other quarterbacks do? Well, that's three. That's to the flat. Now, does he have that mentality? And until we see that, that will be my critique. It's not a criticism.
Right.
Until we see it in the games, especially in the playoff games, that's very, very important
and
to me.
And going back to what Nick said, I think cover two is what they want, to get Tyreek Hill one-on-one with a safety where he can run and turn.
Because they do play him in that slot.
That's exactly what they want. If you look at Andy Reid, he always had great running backs, from Brian Westbrook to Shady McCoy to Jamal Charles, Chadrick West, Spencer Ware. Mm. Then Kareem Hunt came out of nowhere. And then now Damian Williams is
5 yards of carry.
Exactly. So he has to run the ball to be successful. I know Patrick Mahomes can air it out, but he has to get the running game going first to air it out.
First-time quarterbacks were 0-3 last weekend. I'm just wondering, when it comes to experience, when you look at Patrick Mahomes, how much more, I guess, experience that a guy like Andrew Luck is going to have more than, say, a guy like Mahomes, and if that's going to affect the, hey, I need to do what I need to do. I need to get 4 yards here. Maybe I don't throw it down.
Well, I can speak to that. Patrick Mahomes' worst games, or the worst beginnings he's had, have been in the biggest spots. So this is, and now they've been on the road, but where he has struggled early was the first half Monday Night Football against Denver, the first few drives against New England, the first few drives against the Rams. Those games, national TV, big spotlight games, he struggled early, then found himself late. He cannot do that in this game. Whatever the version of getting a guy a layup, to getting a guy to the free throw line, whatever that version is of have his first pass be a completion for 6 yards, that's the play they need to run. Because he needs to have the success early. Because I have seen nerves get to him early in games. He's settled, but we've seen that in games this year.
B-Flowers, I have one for you. Give us a little wild card, because you and I are very, very familiar with Eric Berry. Nick always talks about him coming back for this playoff. What does he add to a defense? What type of player and what type of character does he bring to the football field?
He's the emotional leader on this team, not just this defense, on this team. When he's on the field, this defense feel like they have a chance. This team feel like he have a chance. He can.
So among all them guys that they have, because Eric's a very, very quiet guy. You're talking about he's got the attention of everyone in the locker room?
In the locker room. Before everybody comes, before a game, they huddle around Eric Berry. Even when he was hurt, he'll still come to the games. Everybody huddle around him. He gets this team fired up and going before the game. And when he's on the back end, you know he might come up with a hard hit, a pick. He's great in the run game. So they definitely need his presence on this defense. And that can slow down Andrew Luck at least a little bit.
Why do you think a Chiefs team that usually a team that has Chris Jones, 15 sacks, Dee Ford, 10-plus sacks, Justin Houston, if you have three excellent pass rushers, maybe that's not going to make you a great defense, but you're not going to be the 31st ranked defense like the Chiefs are. Why do you think they've struggled so much defensively, despite the fact that they can get after the passer?
Because the front end and the back end go hand in hand.
Yes.
If you can't cover on the outside, they, even though they're getting sacks, they still can be hacked. They can just throw the ball up on fade routes, get penalties, and get big plays. The defensive backs from Kansas City has to show up today to get these guys, just some time to get home and just be the disruptor.
You have to believe in each other. Each level of the defense has to believe in it. That's what you see Baltimore. They don't have the best talent, but what they do, they all move in unison. The linebackers, the coverage all match up. So when you get a breakdown in coverage, what you start to see is linebackers start to freelance and defensive line, because they got more talent, they start to freelance and they need to have faith that every guy is going to do his job, and that's how you're able to get it done at all three of those levels. We haven't seen that in Kansas City. A lot like the L.A. Rams. They got great corner play.
And they got Aaron Donald up front.
Okay, so, but we don't see them play good defense because they all have to be married together. Back in with that intermediate part of the defense and that front line trying to give constant pressure and taking them out of the running game.
Brendan, thanks so much for coming
in
today.
Thanks for having me.
Really good stuff. Come back again.
Yeah, I'm sorry I know you, man.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. We have to bring you back.
Nets emerging star Spencer Dinwiddie joins us next on First Things First.
Oh, yeah, let's do this.
First things first, last night the Nets lost a tough one to the Celtics. Spencer Dinwiddie had a nice game off the bench, scoring 15 points for Brooklyn. He's averaging 17 points per game this season. And, more importantly, he now joins us here this morning on First Things First.
What
Spencer,
up, man? Good to see you.
Thanks for
greatly
being with us.
Greatly appreciate you joining us, man, too. Especially after last night and everything. You could have canceled big time this and everything.
He didn't. Hey, Spencer, do you follow the season as you're playing? Do you watch other games? Do you get a chance to see who's doing what? I mean, how much of a fan of the NBA are you while you're in the middle of a season?
Oh, a big fan. I mean, well, let me not say fan. I guess it's more kind of leisurely scouting.
Okay.
But I definitely watch League Pass every night.
Oh, do you?
Things. Yeah, yeah. I watch all the games. You know, it's a big part of my life, and I love doing it.
And so people should know a little bit about kind of your trajectory and your story. I would say at every point of your basketball career up until maybe 3 weeks ago, a guy that was maybe underrated. That coming out of high school, you weren't five-star recruit. Mm-hmm. At Colorado, it took some time, and then you, when you had finally established yourself, you hurt your knee, right? And that made you go from a guy that was going to be a first-round pick to second-round pick. You bounce around the G League a bit, a number of stints down there, and finally get a real opportunity, I would argue, last year. I watched a lot of the Nets last year because I moved here. And then this year, in the argument for the best sixth man in basketball, and the Nets rewarded you. You got you had a great 24-hour stretch. I think you scored 39 points and then got $34 million. I'm not maybe the other way around. Tell us about the journey. Like the journey from a guy who I'm sure always wanted to play professionally, but I bet even some of your coaches at times were like, oh, you can play professionally. It'll be in Turkey. It'll be a nice living to getting to where you are now.
Yeah, I mean, I would credit my parents with that. They never told me I couldn't do anything in my life. They believed in me from the jump, from day one. And that type of belief has been pretty much what's carried me through my career because I've been the kid that was crazy enough to think that he was going to go to the NBA even though he was the 150th best player in his high school class. And that confidence didn't waver. And it's what allowed me to, you know, keep pushing through barriers and walls and things as they've risen.
Yeah, now you've talked about high school not being rated that way, but it seems like in listening to you on a podcast, reading articles about you, you've always had that mindset that you were an elite talent, regardless of what people had you rated. Then you got hurt in college. You kind of switched it there that I'm supposed to be a lottery pick.
Yeah.
So even though you were going through the G League, couldn't find a spot on a roster in the Detroit with, man, they're stacked with guards. You might not ever get an opportunity. You always thought you were an elite player. And how has that transferred over to the Nets? You got a lot of guys with some similar stories. Either didn't get a chance, hurt, didn't have the type of rep. How has that led you and the Nets to be able to get this type of chemistry that has you guys in the playoff hunt?
Yeah, I think with all of us having similar stories like that, it kind of creates a bond between brothers that other teams may or may not have. All of us having gone through that fire, we all understand, you know, what it's like to kind of be an outcast or be cast aside. And we know how important it is to really come together, work together, and the power in the unit.
All right, so you did lose last night, but overall the Nets have been playing pretty well in this last stretch. You've won 6 of your last 10. Like C said, if the playoffs started today, you'd be in it right now. What do you credit to this team turning things around?
I think everybody kind of points to a players only film session we had where Jared Dudley and Damari Carroll were very vocal. And, you know, people think it might have been an airing of grievances or something like that. It really wasn't. It was a lot more technical analysis and, you know, helped our communication as a unit. And then, you know, our organization is first class from top down. You know, Sean Marks is our GM and Kenny Atkinson as our coach, amongst obviously our massive player development staff and assistant coaches. Just top down, it's first class, and we're finally getting to reap some of those rewards.
Anytime I hear a story about the team, somewhere along there, man, they throw Jared Dudley in there. Tell us, man, he's part of the mix. And in critical minutes, I have seen you guys put him on the floor. You guys play small. And the type of chemistry you got, and he makes big buckets and make big plays. What does he mean to that team right now?
right now he's like having a second coach on the floor.
Yep.
You know, he is the vet, you know. Like, DeMarco's our vet as well, but
sometimes I look at his body, too. I'm thinking, yeah, y'all definitely got a coach on the floor.
No. Hey, I completely understand.
Because he got a body built by Hostess Twinkie, not like Jim Moore.
I'm not throwing my man under the bus.
You can tell him CC said it.
But, yeah, no, I definitely would tell him CC said it. But, you know, he's just like having another coach on the floor. And the spacing he gives us at the four spot, being able to shoot the three, and just making timely buckets. I mean, he fakes the handoff in critical moments all the time and gets a layup. So, you know, he definitely helps us. And, you know, it's been a pleasure playing with him.
And this is something I think a lot of NBA fans and unfortunately even some NBA teams don't understand. When you're in a rebuild, which the Nets were in, now you guys are in a next stage of that, trying to be a playoff contender. But you can't just have young players.
Yeah.
You can't just have kids. Like Jared Dudley, I know him a little bit as well. And if people look at the contract he has and his points per game, and they're like, wait, what? How does this make sense? But if you watch the team, they've got to have someone who not only is a coach on the floor, but when you start out 8-18 and you have a bunch of really tough, close losses to where you guys don't let go of the rope, where you guys don't say, oh, there's going to be another bad season. Because since then, you guys have reeled off 12 of 16, been one of the best teams in the league. That's the coaching, but it's also those two veteran players you were talking about.
For sure. Because you got to remember, coach can prepare us, but like anything else, when you go into the test, he can't go out there and play for you. So you need your brothers to pick you up when you're not at your best. And I think that's one of the things that vets do better than anybody, regardless of the way that they may be playing that game. You know, I think young guys tend to fluctuate sometimes game to game, depending upon how they're doing individually. And vets don't waver, especially not guys like JD and DC.
More people need to hear your story. It's a remarkable story. 5 times sent to the G League. We talked about the injury. You thought you'd be a lottery pick to now you're making custom shoes. How do you go from the G League? Because I've been cut before.
Yeah.
And I know those kind of things, they stay with you and they continue to motivate you.
It was in preschool, but he was still cut.
Yeah, but
come on now.
Now you're making your own custom shoes. What got you into that? Yeah. And you got to take a tremendous amount of pride into where your life has gone.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the trajectory and where we're at now, it's definitely been a fun journey. And we feel like there's so much more to go. With the Nets, with me individually, obviously with the shoes too. The way it all came about, I used to draw shoes when I was a kid, and it was something that I did just kind of as a passion. I'm not a great artist in terms of, you know, a full spectrum of different types, but for whatever reason, I can draw shoes. When I got back into the league out of the G League, no marquee brand wanted to sign me. And that's kind of when my mind started approaching, like, what would happen if I had my own shoe? What would happen if I took one of these drawings and brought it to life? It's actually not an easy process. And so, you know, I have to thank, you know, Project Dream, which is basically a set of tools to allow influencers to create their own brand. And they pretty much approached me. They needed somebody crazy enough to do it. And I was in a position to try it. And so, you know, I've been having a lot of fun with being able to create that and go forward.
So a lot of these, so this part I didn't know. I knew there were custom shoes. A lot of these are your drawings?
So the shoe itself is my drawing. Now the individual artwork is done by a man named Picasso. He does a lot of cleats for the NFL.
I've heard of Picasso. Yeah. I know Picasso.
All the intricate artwork, like the Space Jam shoe, the Prince shoe, Bruce Lee, all that artwork on top of the shoe, that's all Picasso, and he's been phenomenal in what he's doing.
That's really cool, because I know some of the guys, when they don't get the elite shoe companies that want them, all of a sudden they sign with a company in China, and none of us heard about them.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's the best way to get a check.
Mm-hmm.
What you did, that's a really cool thing. And you're the only guy in the league doing it.
Yeah.
Congratulations, man. Congratulations to you and the team. Man, we're going to make some more games this year.
Mm-hmm.
Need you guys to make the playoffs. We're pulling for you on the All-Star, so if you're out there voting, fans.
Oh, yeah, I need that.
Voting to the All-Star.
Absolutely. And the last Net to make an All-Star team, I'm trying to think, like, maybe.
Did Joe Johnson or D. Will, maybe?
I know they did. I wonder if KG got one, like an honorary
one when he was there.
But you're playing like an all-star.
Thank you.
You're playing like an all-star and sixth man of the year.
Appreciate
Congrats,
it.
Spence,
man.
Thanks so
Thank
much.
You,
really appreciate it.
Thank
I already
you
gave
joining.
You a nickname.
Thank
You've been here for 6 minutes.
Spence,
so.
It's all good.
Spence, that's really good. We got to take a break. Much more First Things First right after this. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. This is First Things First. Look who's here. He's here. And that guy's here. Former All-Pro running back Brian Westbrook joins the show and the conversation. How you doing, Brian?
I'm doing well. How are you guys? Happy New Year.
We're great. Happy New Year.
That's right. That's right.
Got ourselves
a playoff win on the road. Important.
It was a good one. All right. The Saints and Eagles will now face off on Sunday for the second time this season. The first time it was a beatdown. Saints winning 48-7. Carson Wentz was under center at the time. That was before the Eagles' magic run started with Nick Foles still relegated to backup duty. Malcolm Jenkins spoke about the team's mindset now returning to New Orleans.
At that point in time, obviously, that's a low point in our season. But, you know, at no point do you doubt who you have in your locker room. You just know you got to put it together. And since then, I think we responded and earned our opportunity to go back down there.
All right, Brian, it's a simple question. How do the Eagles now go back, make adjustments, and beat the Saints? And your answer can't just be Nick Foles. It has to be something in addition.
Well, Nick Foles certainly plays a big part. But when you look at this Eagles team, they're a much better team than they were in Week 11 against the Saints. And, of course, the Saints put up 48 points. But since then, defensively, they've got a lot of guys more healthy. Avante Maddox, a big addition on the defensive side. Trey Sullivan playing better. The defensive line has played much better, reminiscent of last year. They're getting after the quarterback, making it harder on the opposing quarterback. They've only given up 19 points per game since that game against the Saints. And that's a really good defensive effort, especially with a lot of injuries that they had. Offensively, when you talk about what happened in that Saints game, they take away Zach Ertz. And at that point, Carson Wentz was solely focused on getting the ball to Zach Ertz, and they didn't have an answer. They had no answer for anyone else to try to get the ball to Alshon, try to get the ball to Nelson Aguilar. They couldn't figure it out. And now when you have Nick Foles in there, you have a quarterback that wants to get the ball to a lot of different people, seven, eight guys catching the ball, different guys getting involved offensively. That means a defense can't solely focus on one guy. Totally different offense and defense. That's the one thing that you can lean on for the Eagles to try to get a victory. Yeah, we expect the Eagles to do something from a schematic standpoint, X's and O's standpoint, who they're going to target as far as that Saints defense, who they're going to attack. But how much do you think that the Eagles, just in the back of their mind, Malcolm Jenkins, you talk about those 48 points, and when you watch that game, it was humiliating.
They ran it up a little bit.
Yeah. How much from your professional experience that embarrassment you think will motivate these Eagles against the Saints?
When you talk about motivation, when you look at what they did last year, the underdog, the mask, it's us against the world. That's what the Eagles were all about. Then really the city of Philadelphia is all about that. And now they've getting that mojo back a little bit. Nobody believes
they had to kind of really go out of it, you know, because once you win the championship, you can't be the underdog. But now that they play bad, no playoff hopes,
when
they get in.
When you're 4-5 and you get blown out so badly that Malcolm Jenkins is flipping the bird to the opposing sideline, you are an underdog again.
That's right.
Like, you all of a sudden, you can reclaim that mantle.
Well, you're the sixth seed. Now they're wearing these ski masks. There's a different mentality there, different thought process. I also kind of believe they have a lot of veterans on this football team, and they understand the importance of playoff games. They understand the importance of playing better at the end of the season. They've done a much better job. Different football team now than a few weeks ago.
I really wonder what Drew Brees and Sean Payton and the Saints were thinking watching that Sunday night game, Bears-Eagles. Because they were either going to play the Cowboys if the Bears won, or if the Eagles won, they're obviously playing the Eagles. And they played the Cowboys and lost to them. It was their worst offensive game of the year. They played the Eagles and whooped them. Their best offensive game of the year. I still think they would have rather played the Cowboys. Yeah. I think that the New Orleans Saints were looking at that game and saying, man, like, if the Eagles are able to come away with this one, with the championship experience, with the momentum of the last month of football, with whatever superstitious belief they have in Foles, and the revenge factor, I bet the Saints were disappointed that the Eagles beat the Bears and that they're getting them instead of getting the Dallas Cowboys.
Two of the biggest things in professional football, sports, in life, is confidence and momentum. Right now, the Eagles have momentum, and they have a lot of confidence. They went into Chicago and took that game from the best defense in the league. They went in and found a way against the best defense, one of the better teams in the league. They did that. Now they're going against the Saints. They have a chip on their shoulder. They're mad. They're upset. And I think it's going to be a good opportunity for the Eagles to try to get a win.
Listen, it's not the most popular topic right now to talk about the word, at least on this set, magic with Nick Foles. It is no doubt this team is playing much better. It happens to coincide with when Nick Foles took over under center. They're healthier. Guys that weren't playing well in the beginning of the season are playing well. It happens to be while Nick Foles is playing quarterback for this team. And you wonder if the guys in this locker room, and you laughed when Nick brought up the word superstitious. You kind of laughed a little bit. There's something going on, and maybe they like playing with that, you know, underdog mentality, but there is something going on since Nick Foles took over.
You're right. I laugh because in the city of Philadelphia, you hear and you see Saint Nick signs. There's a saint. They have a shrine in the locker room. We've seen that, talked about that before. But you're right. Guys are playing much better around him. Jason Peters had his best game of the year last week. Lane Johnson playing much better after the Pro Bowl snub. And I just think offensive line, protection-wise, they're playing totally different. But also Nick does something that Carson wasn't willing to do. He's getting more guys involved. I mean, almost as simple as that. Doug has been committed to the run, and offensively, they're just hard to defend. Defenses want to key on one thing. They want to say, hey, we know on third down they're going to run. They know we're going to pass on third down. With this offense, you don't have that ability to do that because so many guys are involved.
So here's the thing. I was thinking about this a lot last night because I don't believe in magic. But I do know for a scientific fact there is something known as the placebo effect, right? Mm-hmm. You take a group of people, tell them where you're all taking a pill to make you healthier. Some of them get it, some of them get a sugar pill. And yet some of the people who get that sugar pill start to feel better, start to feel healthier because the mind has tricked them. I wonder, even if magic's not real, if enough people in the Philly locker room believe there's magic there, do they start playing better? Is there a football placebo effect of Nick Foles coming into that locker room? Now, all of a sudden, you are playing better, that it's not just coincidental. Because I'm running out of explanations because I'm not a superstitious person. I'm not someone that believes you got to sit on this couch, you got to watch a game this way. But I am seeing this team play its best football in a calendar year.
The placebo effect is we believe in us. Because at no point do you think, and this is where the magic carpet ride, at no point do you think, and you've played on some teams that played well with the backup, you don't think that your job is easier. You start focusing on the fine details and be like, my job is more important now because we have a backup. So we start doing that together, and I care about my fellow brother. I care about my teammate. And that togetherness, that's what makes teams get on a winning streak. That's what makes teams play beyond their ability. Yeah, you might think on the surface, this guy came in, but there's too many things going right for Philadelphia. You mentioned the play calling. You mentioned the running game. You mentioned spreading the ball out, attacking the field, taking care of the football. Man, the defensive front playing better, the offensive line getting healthier. Like, those are real football facts that make teams play better and help you win games.
To your point, we had Jeff Garcia come in when Donovan got hurt. And the first practice, I'll never forget it, the first walkthrough, Jeff comes in and says, listen, everybody shut up. Listen to me. I'm the guy. I'm the man in the huddle at this point. That makes you feel confident.
He sounded like a starter.
You sound like a guy that you want to follow that guy and go to work with him. Jeff did a great job with that. And I think the same feeling is with Nick. This is a guy that won the Super Bowl for us. He's a Super Bowl MVP. You insert him into the huddle, and your team has a much more confidence.
And you mentioned the most important things in life or in sports are confidence and momentum. And to be able to pull in your memory, preferably recent memory, of experience of having done it. When the Eagles found themselves down 5 to the Bears late in that game on the last drive, they could go 2 weeks back to being down to the Houston Texans in a game that also could have ended their season. And knowing we drove the field there to get the game-winning field goal. Like, they know that. And they did that with this quarterback. They know that they have the ability to do these things with this quarterback because they've done it. I think that helps them a ton as well.
All right, Brian, stick around. Got to take a break. Coming up, can Ezekiel Elliott power the Cowboys to a win over the Rams? That's next on First Things First. The NFC Divisional Playoffs kick off this weekend. It is on Fox. On Saturday, Zeke and the Cowboys take on Todd Gurley and the Rams. And then on Sunday, Nick Foles and the Eagles battle Drew Brees and the Saints. It is all happening this weekend on Fox and the Fox Sports app.
You're a running back. You like those games.
Oh,
those guys are the best in the league. We know that.
All right, this will make you scratch your head. Back here at Brian Westbrook, and we're going viral. Odell Beckham Jr. has spent his offseason recruiting with his most recent efforts focused on a chimp and a lion. And if you follow OBJ on Instagram, there are a number of interesting videos. This one, one of them.
All right, we might have differing opinions on the set about this. This looks like maybe the most fun thing to do in the world. If you know you're not going to get mauled by those animals.
Well, how do you know that?
Well, I don't. I assume.
Well, you just removed it. I mean, they're a wild animal. You just removed that.
Well, I don't know. I got to see what the sanctuary they're in, the type of training they've got.
They're,
I don't know.
No, so
I know
well
that.
Then.
I know that that looks like an enormous amount of fun.
Okay, just Google. Uh-huh. All right. Monkey eating face.
Right.
Okay.
It happens. It happens. It only needs to take one time for that to happen for them to be out on
the field. I mean, there used to be a day where guys just wanted to be good at, you know, with basketball, football, baseball. Like,
and now?
It used to be that now it's, that ain't even that important.
Yeah. Like, guys wanted to perfect their craft and get better in the offseason, never took a day off. Now it's a little bit different.
Dude, talking about, he don't know if he wants to play with Eli, but he can play with a tiger, with a monkey.
Like, you're saying we couldn't go back in the archives and find video of you and any wild animal sharing a ice pop?
No,
I don't want to live in a world where a man, after making another Pro Bowl, can't go spend some time at an animal sanctuary.
No, I just have some small goals in life. I just wanted to get away from the creatures, the roaches I was living with. That's just small little things. Not no traveling around the world, no wild animals. No, I'm not about that.
Different world.
But, hey, man,
different
go ahead.
World.
Enjoy yourself. Live your
don't
life.
Don't they throw their poo-poo at you,
is.
Too? Don't they do
they
that?
They didn't. They didn't, though. You run that risk. Just
all
like
right,
you
Brian.
Run the risk of the face getting ripped off.
The Rams enjoyed their bye last week, waiting to see who they'd host in the division round this weekend. Turns out it'll be a hot Cowboys team led by a quarterback in Dak Prescott, with a ton of confidence right now, and a running back in Ezekiel Elliott, who's been great all season. In fact, this game could come down to a battle of the two best running backs in the NFL, with Zeke and Todd Gurley. And head coach Sean McVay says they've got a lot in common, these two.
When you look at Zeke, I think he's, similar to Todd, one of the most complete backs in the league, extremely productive. I think he's got the ability to go through you or go around you with speed. He's gotten a lot more involved in the pass game this year. I think he's truly a complete back, and you could see that, a lot of what they do is predicated on, just him getting a bunch of touches.
All right, Brian, let's talk about the way both of these teams, the Rams and the Cowboys, use their running backs to help them. Are they different the way each of them do?
Well, when I look at the Rams, I kind of feel like they actually want to pass the ball a lot more. They certainly will use one of the best backs in the league, Todd Gurley, and get him 25, 30 carries a game. But I feel like they want to be a passing team. They want to have explosive plays down the field. But when I look at the Cowboys, they want to run the football 30 times a game, throw the ball only 25 times a game, and dominate on the ground, pound the rock down your throat until the defense says, okay, we've had enough. We don't want to see 21 at all anymore. And so when I look at the two backs, I love the way both of them play. Mm-hmm. Listen, both of these guys can catch the ball out of the backfield. Both of these guys are a big-time threat in the running game. But when I watch Zeke, that's the guy that I love even a little, just a little bit more. We're talking about splitting hairs
here. Absolutely.
But I just love the way he goes out there and he said, listen, I'm going to take it to you every single time. I'm going to take your will away to play in the third and fourth quarter. To me, that's a dominant nature, dominant mindset.
So I find it really interesting that you appreciate or like Zeke more, even like you said, it's marginal. When I feel like Gurley's more of the style you were, more of the dual threat player, right? Like Gurley reminds, I know you guys have different body types, but Gurley reminds you more of yourself than Zeke does, correct?
Oh, no, there's no doubt about it. I was never a guy that was, I'm not going to punish you. I'm going to try to make you miss and try to get to the edge and get out of bounds if I could. But Todd Gurley, when you talk about Todd, he has lateral quickness. He's big. He's physical when he needs to be, but he's a little bit more finesse than Zeke. And I'm not trying to bash Todd because he's
all.
A great back, but Zeke is one of these downhill, I want to run you over type of backs. Todd can run away from you and run around you in a different way. I love both of these guys, though.
One is, we have to ask ourselves the question is, what type of NFL are we going to see in week number two? We saw the defenses tighten up in week number one, the wild card. Now, based on the spreads and what Vegas is saying, and we have the best offenses going, teams with the bye, it seems like they're going to score more points. But in the NFL, September, October, November, averaging 48 points a game. Now we're in January, only averaging 36 points a game. So what style of game are we going to see? And which one of these defensive lines is going to make up their mind before the game? Because you can't do it once the game starts. That we are not going to let Ezekiel Elliott, we are not going to let Todd Gurley dominate this game. Because for me, Ndamukong Suh, we go out and get you in free agent. This is what we brought you here for.
Yeah.
Now, Dallas, in the totality of what they send at you, Like, they're going to try to take you out of the running. They have that mindset, but very, very young and sometimes a little undisciplined. But in Ndamukong Suh, this is the reason why you are not a pass rusher. And you cannot have the difference in the pass rush ability that the Rams front has had and the difference in them not being able to defend the run. When you get in a playoff game like this, playing at home, that defensive front of the Rams have to make up their mind that Ezekiel Elliott is going to be a long day. You're going to get 20 carries, but you're not going to be 7-0 like they have been once he's touched the ball 20 times, Nick.
Listen, and I just don't think the Rams are built for that as well as the Cowboys are built for it. And by that, I mean...
built for stopping the run?
Correct. I think that...
But this is one game, though.
No, of course. I'm not saying they can't do it. In a one-game sample, they certainly have the athletes. You don't look at it and you're like...
You're worried about the personnel, maybe the linebackers matching up with those
exactly
defensive
right.
tackles.
Like, okay,
I got you.
Because I look at the Cowboys front seven, and I say, even if they do get Gurley out in space... they got some fast linebackers now.
Right.
Yes. They got guys that can go sideline to sideline as well as any linebackers in the league. We know how good that front seven, Crawford and Lawrence, had played in week one of the playoffs. So I feel like the Cowboys can come into this game saying, we're going to duplicate defensively what we just did against Seattle, mm-hmm. eliminating the best run game in the NFL. The Rams are going to have to do something they might be built to do, but they haven't done all year.
Right.
There is, which is, you know what? We got two great corners. We're going to leave them in man-to-man. We're going to dedicate a lot of people stopping the run, and we're going to trust our talent. Mm-hmm. They have the personnel to where I think they can do it. They just haven't shown me they're going to do it.
If both of these teams can negate each other's run, you look at their quarterbacks, and you have Jared Goff and Dak Prescott, who a lot of people would say the jury's still out on both of these guys in their third year. Very talented teams. Still some questions about the quarterback. If it does happen to come down to these two, because Gurley and Zeke have been sort of slow down. How do you see that playing out?
Yeah, I like both quarterbacks, but I think at this point, I'm leaning towards Dak Prescott just because he has a lot more confidence in the playoffs. He played well last week. He did a very good job. He had the touchdown interception, but at the end of the day, and I spoke about this last week when I was on the show, that week 17, 44 attempts, four touchdowns for Dak, that provided some confidence. That confidence and momentum again that we're talking about, that provided him some confidence. That allowed him to go into the playoffs saying, I know and I feel confident in throwing the football down the field. I've watched Jared Goff get flustered not being able to complete the ball deep down the field, him not wanting to check down to try to get yards down the field. I think Dak is comfortable with that. To your point earlier, I think Dallas is ready to play this nasty, dirty, physical-type football game. I'm not sure if the Rams are ready to play that type of game. I'm not sure if they're ready to play football where you get a bunch of Zeke downhill, 25 carries, to be able to tackle him every single play. I don't know if they're ready to play that game. We've seen Dallas play that game. They played it last week.
And if this matters at all, Dallas' season is already a wild success. To come from 3-5 to where they're in the final eight, they've already won a playoff game. They have done so many things to where even if they lose to the Rams, people would say, hey, this is a hell of a step in the right direction. If the Rams lose this game, then it's like, what the hell was the whole year about? Like, what has this McVay-Goff era been? It's been 11 wins, one and done in the playoffs at home. It's now going to be 12 wins, one and done in the playoffs and go home like that. To me, that's real pressure on the Rams this game.
In the playoffs, you have to be willing to run the football and stop the run. I think Dallas is built to do both of those things. And they could do that successfully. I think they win this football game.
FS1 is your destination for the day's best sports shows. Right? Tune in for the biggest personalities on the biggest stories.
And it all starts with you.
And it all starts with this girl. We get you started right here on First Things First. Follow us down the line, kicking off at 6:30 a.m. Eastern every morning, Monday through Friday, only on FS1.
Starts with this girl.
Dap, dap. Time now for us to go viral. All right, so Clemson took down Alabama last night, 44-16. It's the Tigers' second national title in 3 years, the first 15-0 season in modern college football history.
Wow.
So how do you celebrate? You celebrate with a dance party in the locker room.
Well, let me see the dance, and this guy's just laying on the floor. There we go. A little live stream. Put it on the gram. Okay.
It looks like a music video, doesn't it?
Yeah, Dabo's done some dancing in the locker rooms before, you know, so I thought last night he would cut loose a little bit.
Dabo and Drew Brees on the corner of our Caucasian brothers who look good dancing in these football locker rooms. Don't look out
Baker.
Of place.
Baker.
Look
very,
Baker.
Baker's,
Baker's on
very
that corner
good
as well.
Yeah.
Good one, Jenna Wolf.
Thank you
yes.
very much.
Guys that don't look uncomfortable.
Danny Ainge.
And for the coach God. To be able to mix in and just show, make himself a little vulnerable. You see him doing a wet willy when he was up there getting the trophy and everything. Yeah. No, they did it. Put it in his ear and everything. So, I mean, that right there for a college coach, because it's about control. And a lot of times, there's not a whole bunch of fun.
You wouldn't see Nick Saban doing a wet willy.
Man, you pull back a stump, you try to give Nick Saban a wet willy. That ain't going to go well for anybody involved.
No, because he would have got fired. He would have punched the kid.
All right, time for stories to start your morning.
Yes.
Sticking with this game, Trevor Lawrence dazzled last night for the Clemson Tigers. The true freshman finished with nearly 350 yards and three touchdowns. Chris, how impressive was Trevor Lawrence's night?
Oh, he was amazing. Watch all the throws where, not forget where the ball was, watch him get hit on those throws to be able to make those big-time throws. We hadn't seen the pure pro-style quarterback be effective against Alabama defenses, but, man, they were aggressive throughout the game. Got off to a little rocky start, got his nerves settled, but as impressive I've seen him fresh. We thought Tua last year, man, as a freshman was impressive, but, man, this kid, every game he started, Nick, and finished, man, they won this year for Clemson by 20 points.
Right. They blew everybody out in every game that he was the starter and didn't get knocked out of. I want to give you credit, and I know this is always tough to do because then I always surprise Chris Carter knows football, but you called the offensive line, man. Nobody was talking about the Clemson offensive line being the key to this game. Nick Saban team, no sacks, no turnovers. Quinnen Williams going to be maybe the number one pick of the draft, neutralized for the most part.
Yes.
Yes, it was a dominant performance by Clemson on all sides of the ball. It started with the offensive line keeping that quarterback upright.
Something else you called? Ohio State quarterback Dwayne Haskins, who led the Buckeyes to a Rose Bowl win and a 13-1 record this season, he'll enter the 2019 NFL Draft. Haskins is the presumptive favorite to be the first quarterback taken. See, how good can Haskins be in the pros?
Haskins should be, he should be a Pro Bowl player. He has the type of talent. He has the type of arm talent. I believe he's a dynamic leader that he's going to grow. Now, he's still a very, very young player. I still believe this, Nick, to be true. This is about situations. 99% of the players in the NFL have to be in the right system. I don't believe it's important for him to play early. I believe you have to be able to support him as an organization with a running game. But I believe he is going to be an elite thrower of the football, special season. 50 touchdown passes, the greatest quarterback to ever play at Ohio State.
The best situation for him of the realistic ones is right here in New York. You already have the running back. You already have the wide receiver. You have a quarterback they don't want to get rid of just yet, so he wouldn't have to start immediately.
I can see that.
He can learn for whatever the criticisms of Eli Manning are as a player. He knows how to be quarterback of the New York Giants. You can learn from him. Because my only question about Haskins is experience. It's tough to only play in 14 games and then go into the pros, so that's why I think New York would be a great fit for him.
All right, and ending with the Packers, who are reportedly hiring Titans offensive coordinator Matt LaFleur to be their head coach. LaFleur spent time with Sean McVay in L.A. before this past role in Tennessee. C, did you like this hire?
I like the hire, and the reason why, because I spent some time with Matt LaFleur in covering the Dolphins versus the Titans week number one. Him and I spent some time together talking football, talking the X's and O's. And sometimes, if you're ever going for a job interview, sometimes your resume might not match up to the job that you are interviewing for, but people like your personality. And that's what I believe that the Green Bay Packers, what they saw. They like his personality. They like the way he talked about football and what they thought he could do with Aaron Rodgers. Because I believe, yes, he is one of the bright young minds that we have. And just because his resume doesn't match up, because you're not going to be able to pull film from last year in Tennessee with the Titans and be able to transfer that to, I wonder what they're going to do in Green Bay. So I believe he's a lot like Sean McVay. He was that way in Washington before the Rams took the chance in hiring him. I believe that Green Bay, they do have the right guy because he's dynamic in the interview. He really talks football well, and that becomes very, very important because in teaching football. So Aaron Rodgers, I believe, got lucky. He's got a guy that they can grow together with as a young coach. That's what Green Bay has gone for in their last number of hires on the offensive side in their head coach
right,
is going to be.
It follows the trend of Holmgren, McCarthy, as far as young guy, kind of taking a chance, first head coaching gig for a guy.
Yes.
Young at the time, offensive mind for Holmgren and McCarthy. This is, and by the way, it should be noted, he was a quarterback's coach the year Matt Ryan set all those records, and he learned under Kyle Shanahan. And then he was the offensive coordinator last year in Los Angeles, learned under Sean McVay. This year, the Titans' offense was not impressive, and I understand C's point, which is there any coordinator that would have made that offense impressive? I will say this for the Packers. This is the move I cautioned against. The last time I cautioned a team, go with the safe choice instead of the upside choice, it was the Browns in the draft. I said, take Darnold or Rosen instead of Baker because you need to take the safest choice, not the choice with the most upside. They took Baker. They're thrilled they did. With the Packers, I said, when you only have 4 or 5 years left of Aaron Rodgers, go with a coach like Jim Caldwell that you know is not going to flame out. They went with the upside choice. Hopefully for them, it works out the way it looks like the Browns draft.
One thing Jenna asked me, well, Chris, what did you see in Tennessee this year that makes you think that it's going to transfer to Green Bay? Well, what I saw was a guy who was not stuck in his concepts of a lot of motion, 3-4 receivers on the field. No, he adapted to his personnel. So a lot of times we see guys who are married to what their philosophy is and they can't adapt. He adapted to having Henry. He adapted to having a big, strong offensive line, a young dual-threat quarterback in Marcus there. So he will adapt to having the best thrower of the football that we have in the NFL. I'm excited to see what he's going to do with the Packers.
All right, let's get back to last night's surprising outcome in the national championship game. Clemson blowing out Alabama. 44-16 was your final. The Tigers winning their second national title in 3 years. And to break it all down, Fox lead college football analyst Joel Klatt joins us. Joel, thanks for being on this great college football ride all season long. Good morning.
Bet. Yeah, good morning. Good to be here, guys.
Well, let's start sort of overall. What stood out the most to you in Clemson's win over Alabama last night?
Well, first of all, it was just a beatdown, you know, and we haven't seen Alabama play that poorly in a decade. And Clemson had a lot to do with that. Their game plan was tremendous, and that's where I'll start. My biggest takeaway was the fact that Saban and his coaching staff got outcoached badly in that football game. And I think you have to start taking a look at how many times Saban has had to replace assistant coaches versus Dabo Swinney. Just to give you a sense, in this 4 games that they've played over the last 4 years, the Clemson side has had the same coordinators the entire time, offensively and defensively. Meanwhile, every single time that Alabama is trotting out there to play Clemson, they've got a new combination of coordinators. It started with Lane Kiffin and Kirby Smart, and then it went on, and they had all sorts of different combinations. You had Jeremy Pruitt in there. You've got Taj Lapoy now. You've got Brian Daboll had a stint as the offensive coordinator. Now it's Mike Locksley. Steve Sarkisian was in there one time calling plays. I think the lack of continuity for coaching staff is one of the reasons why Alabama got outcoached so badly last night against a team that has had a lot of continuity as far as the coaching staff goes.
Joe, but you still have to be surprised that this Alabama staff, Nick Saban, Mike Locksley going on to be the Maryland, calling the plays there at Alabama, they laid a goose egg in the second half. You still have to be shocked by Alabama's lack of productivity in the second half of that game.
No doubt about it. And CC, you hit the nail on the head there. The lack of productivity was alarming. The fact that Tua Tagovailoa was not seeing thing was alarming. They were not prepared. And it got me thinking about the semifinal game. Because here's what it looked like to me. Chris, it looked like to me that Clemson prepared for Alabama for a month and Alabama prepared for Clemson for 1 week. So I started to think to myself, maybe Clemson knew that they were just better than Notre Dame and they could beat them with somewhat of a vanilla game plan, and they were game planning for Alabama this whole time. Meanwhile, you know Alabama had to give their full attention to Kyler Murray and that Oklahoma offense. Maybe that was a factor, because it certainly looked that like Alabama was not prepared for some of the nuance that Clemson brought to them in the game plan.
What impressed you more last night, the guy throwing passes for Clemson, Trevor Lawrence, or the 5 guys protecting Trevor Lawrence and that offensive line and keeping him upright against what is historically always a great Alabama front?
Well, they were able to run the football a little bit. ETN did have a decent night. It wasn't a great night, but that, I thought, neutralized the rush just a little bit. And then, Nick, for the money, give me Justin Ross, the wide receiver. If you're asking me who was the most impressive player of the entire night, it was Ross. I know Lawrence is going to get all the accolades, but Lawrence threw a couple of those passes that, candidly, were very average passes, and Ross bailed him out. bailed him out. He hit a couple of very open receivers down the field. I don't want to take away from what he did as a freshman, but Justin Ross is also a true freshman, and he made some of the more spectacular catches that I've seen in a long time. Two one-handed catches, one reaching back all the way back behind a defensive back on a third down. Justin Ross, for me, was the most important, most impressive, I should say, Clemson Tiger.
Joel, we've had you on the show just about every week of this college football season, and every week I ask you about Tua Tagovailoa and just how dominant he's been, how good he is, how he doesn't get rattled ever in big games, and then he had the ankle sprain, still came out and played. What did you make of the way he struggled last night?
Yeah, something was going on from the get-go. In that first series, he doesn't see the corner fall off of that little outside route, and the corner goes and takes it for a pick six. He doesn't see the corner fall off a different route. He's got a wide open guy in the flat. He throws it down the field, forces it to Jerry Jeudy. I thought that he was playing outside of himself for the first time all season long. Quarterbacks can sometimes do this. They start to press. They want to create offense rather than letting the offense come to them. And that's when they get into trouble. And that's what happened to Tua. Again, he was not prepared with a lot of the looks. Give Brent Venables a lot of credit, the defensive coordinator for Clemson. They had a lot of what I would call automatic dog blitzes, which means that on a short motion from the outside, let's say, or some other type of formational look that they had some tendency against Alabama, they would just automatically blitz. And so all of a sudden, the corner was in there. They weren't protecting. They weren't side adjusting. They didn't have any hots on that side. And that game plan rattled Tua from the get-go, and he was never himself.
What does winning two national championships for Dabo Swinney and the Clemson Tigers, and what does it mean going forward for college football?
Well, we got two really good programs right now. We've got two elite programs and everyone else chasing. I think there's a handful of teams. I would say Oklahoma, Ohio State, and Georgia are your next tier. Maybe Texas rises into that with their win over Georgia in the Sugar Bowl. But those are the four teams that are now looking at these two teams. But the margin, CC, is really, really stark right now. Clemson has put themselves on the mountaintop, and now Alabama's going to have to go after them. I think Alabama's the best team in the country, at least when you're talking about the team that could potentially beat Clemson next year. But these are far and away the two best programs in the country. But Dabo Swinney has put himself on what I would consider right now an unequaled pedestal over the last 3 years. The last 3 years, you've seen two national championship games with these two teams, and Clemson has won both of them. In fact, the last time that we saw Alabama beat Clemson for a national championship, remember, it took a kick return, also a fake kick that they had to execute in order to get that done. Saban threw the gauntlet at him last night, and Clemson was prepared.
Let's stay there for a second, Joel. When Saban won his first title at Bama nearly a decade ago, we had told you they were about to go on a dominant run. That wouldn't have surprised anyone. And if I'd have told you there's going to be one team by the end of the next decade in all of college football that is neck and neck with them, I don't know, Clemson would have been the 25th school you name?
Right. Well, you would have said Texas, because that was the first time Alabama won the national championship. Texas was right there.
Or Texas, or maybe USC comes back, or one of the Florida schools, or Ohio. Clemson, I think people, because of recency bias, don't realize how unexpected this is. Can you put in the context for college football what Dabo Swinney has done in building a new blue blood amongst blue bloods?
That's a great question. Here's where I would first start. I believe that there were two turnarounds, right? Taking a program from one point to another that had like the most distance to gain. Gary Barnett at Northwestern in the mid-90s, when he took Northwestern to a Rose Bowl and won the Big Ten. That was an incredible, incredible coaching job, what he did in the 90s. And then what Bill Snyder did at Kansas State, taking historically the worst program in the history of college football into a perennial contender, even into a year, I believe, in 98, in which they were ranked number one in the country. Those are the two I would say. But now, taking Clemson from a team that was just an average ACC football team forever, ever since their early 80s national championship, and then they were just a very average football team. Maybe they would win 10 games. And now to put them on the dominant path that they've been on, I think Dabo Swinney has done as good or better a job than even Gary Barnett with Northwestern or Bill Snyder with Kansas State. And those are two of what I would consider the greatest coaching jobs in the history of the sport when you're taking a program from one point to another with the most space to gain.
Joel, before we let you go, I got to ask you about Dwayne Haskins, declared for the NFL draft yesterday. Do you think he is the best college quarterback on the board?
This year, yes, I do. I think he's going to be the number one quarterback taken. I think that there's a lot of room for growth for Dwayne. He's got experience to gain, certainly. I think he would probably benefit from sitting behind a veteran. I heard you guys talking about the New York Giants. I think that would be a pretty good fit for him. I don't know if Jacksonville would be a great fit for him just because I think he would have to play right away. And I don't know if he's gotten the reps requisite to do that. But having said that, there's a couple of quarterbacks that are in next year's draft and then one in two drafts that NFL evaluators are already salivating over, and that's Tua Tagovailoa, Jake Fromm next year, and then Trevor Lawrence in 2 years. And I think you're going to start to hear a lot about Trevor and his potential NFL prospects in 2 years. But this year it's going to be Dwayne Haskins that likely will be the number one quarterback taken in the NFL draft.
Joel, it's been a great season. Thank you so much for being with us, sharing your insight.
You bet. Much appreciated. Absolutely. It's always great coming on with you guys.
We'll be in touch. Joel, thanks for everything. Much more First Things First right after this. Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.